It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. In the Middle East, all eyes are on Syria as the struggle between the Assad regime and the rebels has developed into a full-scale civil war. We're going to take a look at that situation this morning from three different angles. First, we'll talk about what's happening there right now in terms of the fighting. Then we'll have a discussion about what comes after Assad, assuming he is removed from power. And finally, we'll finish the hour talking about the plight of those displaced by this conflict, the refugees. If you'd like to ask a question or join the discussion about what's happening on the ground in Syria, call right now, because around 25 after, we'll move to the next topic. So here's the number, 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655. Email address talk@WPR.org, or you can post a comment to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. My first guest is Elizabeth Kennedy, AP Bureau Chief for Lebanon and Syria, who talks to us from Beirut, Lebanon this morning. Good morning, or good afternoon there, I guess, or good evening.
Good afternoon.
One of those three ought to work. The rebels seemed to score big last week with their suicide bombing of a high-level security meeting. Syria's defense minister was killed, some other top strategists. We just learned, I think, today that the Assad intelligence chief also died following the blast. There followed assaults on Damascus and Aleppo, Syria's two largest cities. Some border crossings with Turkey and Iraq have been taken by the rebel forces. For a moment there, it seemed like the rebels were really gaining the upper hand, but what's happened since then?
Okay. You're right. The Syrian rebels have definitely been riding a really intense sort of wave of momentum, but this fight is by no means over. That being said, as you said, there are some very, very striking gains. This bomb in Damascus killed four of the president's top lieutenants. I mean, these were guys who are directly in charge of ordering the crackdown. This is really just like the beating heart of this crackdown. So the fact that the rebels were able to penetrate a meeting like that was a major blow and surely a source of some real paranoia within the regime, because a strike like that really could only have been done with the help of an insider. You mentioned a suicide bombing, but it's not clear that it actually was a suicide bombing. But the regime had initially said that, but it seemed that they were backing off of it a little bit. But on the heels of this bombing in Damascus, there was the most sustained and widespread fighting that we've seen over the course of the uprising in Damascus, and now also in Aleppo, which is Syria's second city. So the rebels are really taking aim at these pillars of regime power, and it is striking, and it is a sign that, maybe they're sort of really more powerful and they're gaining strength. But at the same time, you have to keep in mind that these rebels are very disorganized and disparate. They don't hold any sort of territory like we saw in Libya. The Libyan rebels launched their revolution from Benghazi, which was an area that they were able to control, and the rebels don't quite have anything like that. Like I said, this is definitely a wave of momentum, but this fight is not over yet by a long shot.
Yeah, I understand that the Syrian army has retaken the portions of Damascus that the rebels had tried to seize control of, or had at least momentarily seized some control of. The rebels saying they withdrew because they were concerned about the civilian population. There certainly have been a lot of people who've been kind of caught in the crossfire between the opposition groups and the Syrian military, and the Syrian military has shown no squeamishness at all about just flat out bombing whole neighborhoods.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the scene in Damascus is really desperately sad, and the rebels do say that they sort of beat a tactical retreat. It seems that they're running out of weapons, and of course in Damascus, the regime is more powerful. They have much more powerful weapons. There's no, it's very difficult to beat for the rebels to beat the regime in sort of a one-on-one fight. But in terms of, the scene in Damascus, this is a sophisticated city, once a very safe city. And we do hear from residents who said that, we don't want the rebels to be launching, their fight basically from beneath our balcony. And of course, there's lots of anger at the regime for for its heavy-handed tactics as well. But, you know, we've spoken to refugees coming out of Damascus with, holding their bags, their sort of getaway bags that they've packed with their university diplomas and photographs and mementos. And it's a very, very grim scene. It's very sad to see what's happening in Damascus, a city that, Syrians are proud of. And that was a tourist attraction. And it's very sad.
The Syrian military has the hardware. They have the tanks, the helicopters, the jet airplanes, access to a lot of ammunition, weapons, and so forth, and tactics. And they're pretty well organized. You talked about the rebels as not being very well organized. There are a lot of factions within those forces that are opposing the Assad regime. How in the world are they able to achieve any kind of command and control at all?
It's very difficult. From what we can tell, there are dozens, many smaller, small units of what, you can refer to very broadly as the Free Syrian Army, the rebel force. But there's very little communication, and there's very little command from the top. So it's a lot of these groups sort of working independently with, a shared goal of toppling the regime. But this is, this is one of their main problems. They simply cannot unite. They don't have a safe area where they can unify. And, the commander of the Free Syrian Army, as much as he is the commander, is based in Turkey. He's not even based inside Syria. And to some degree, this is the problem with the opposition as a whole, not just the armed opposition. Many of the Syrian opposition leaders that you hear from are not even inside Syria. So it's very difficult for this uprising, for this revolution to get rolling in any serious way, to gain any real traction beyond a sort of war of attrition, because they simply just can't get together. They can't really organize themselves.
The other countries of the world have there are sanctions that have been imposed on Syria, on the Syrian government. Any sign that those sanctions have had any effect?
Not really. Although sanctions can have an effect in the long run, and sort of like just slowly chipping away at the regime. But no, I mean, there have been round after round after round of sanctions from European countries and the U.S. But really, in many ways, Syria is accustomed to being a pariah nation. Do you know what I mean? It's
yes.
This kind of pressure, has not really brought the country to its knees by any stretch of the imagination. So, and then the obvious next question is, why is there no military intervention in Syria like we saw in Libya? And, part of the reason for that is that, Libya was much less explosive than Syria is. It was much more confined to its own borders. Going into Syria could potentially ignite the entire region because of Syria's allegiances with Iran and Hezbollah and Lebanon. So, and there's no strong opposition to rally behind. So it would be very difficult to intervene in any constructive way in Syria.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. What's the thinking about whether or not this conflict could spread to neighboring states? I mean, you have a lot of people there in close proximity. Some of the same sects exist in other countries in the region. What are the chances of this conflict spreading?
Well, the conflict already is spreading. It's already happened. It's happening now. The conflict is spreading. We've already seen some really deadly battles in Lebanon already over the Syria crisis. In Turkey, part of the reason that they're sealing off their border is because they're scared of more of a spillover, which we've already seen. This border with Turkey is 565 miles long. I mean, it's quite a long border, and we've already seen, bullets flying across the frontier. Besides the street battles in Lebanon, we've seen also just, bullets flying across the border. This is a very explosive conflict. There are very porous borders, and lots of different groups have real serious interests in Syria. So a lot of people, a lot of well-armed groups have interest in keeping, Bashar in power, and also in seeing him go. So there's no doubt that that it's already spreading around the region, and it will very likely continue.
We have some callers who want to join us with some questions, and let's start in Madison with Bill. Bill, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Bill in Westfield. Okay,
Bill in West Salem. Go ahead.
Okay, where are the rebels getting their arms? Who's giving them the money? Where are the arms coming from?
The weapons that the Syrian rebels get come from lots of different areas. They get some weapons from the Syrian army, from, you know, people who want to make money, some sort of some soldiers who have turned. If they, you know, also if they attack tanks, they'll take over the tanks. But also there are, you know, flows of weapons coming in from neighboring countries. Like I said, there are, you know, very porous borders from Jordan and from Lebanon and from Iraq. So they get weapons like that. We've also heard some pledges of support from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, but no one is really owning up to the idea that, you know, we are arming the rebels, but certainly weapons are getting in those ways.
Bill, thanks for that call. A quick question before we take another call. There is now a story out there that Syria has chemical weapons. Do you think it at all possible or likely that they would use them on their own people?
Yeah. Well, they say that they won't use them on their own people, but at the same time, in the same breath, they say that they will use them. They've threatened to use them in the case of a foreign attack, in the case of, you know, foreign aggression. It's significant that Syria has finally acknowledged having these weapons, which they have never done before. And, of course, you know, it's no mystery why they chose to reveal this now. It's because they're scared and they need a really clear intimidation factor on the table immediately. And this entire subject has really escalated the conflict because there are fears that, you know, a sudden collapse of this government in Syria could put the chemical weapons up for grabs. And this is something that concerns, you know, Israel in particular because, you know, they're nervous that Syria's allies and Lebanon, Hezbollah, will get their hands on these weapons. So yes, I mean, the fear definitely remains. I mean, Syria's believed to have nerve agents and mustard gas and Scud missiles that are capable of delivering these sort of lethal chemicals. So yeah, I mean, they have threatened to use them in the case of a foreign attack. So, you know, this is something now that's on the table, which is very concerning to everyone in the region and to Syrians themselves, of course.
Absolutely. Wow. Okay, let's take another call. This time it's Justin in Green Bay. Justin, good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to point out or kind of inquire about why is no one talking about that the main facilitator of the quote-unquote rebels are the Sunni regimes in Arabia, i.e. Qatar, Saudi Arabia. These regimes want Assad out because he is an ally who is aligned with the Shia, who, of course, are headed by Iran. Why is no one discussing that? Everybody's trying to paint the rebels, as you say, as this magnanimous, altruistic group of freedom fighters. And I see more of a mixed bag. And I wanted to get the experts... interpretation of that.
All right, Justin, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. The rebels in Syria are mostly Sunni, that's true, but that's also because the country is overwhelmingly Sunni. I mean, there are very, very concerning sectarian issues that are coming up. But, you know, when this uprising began, the opposition said, we are completely non-sectarian, we are, you know, we're just asking for... you know, for reforms in a country that's very autocratic. But, you know, as this conflict has gone on and on and on, it has, of course, transformed into an armed insurgency that's taken on some very ugly sectarian overtones, certainly. But yeah, I mean, the majority of the rebels are Sunnis, but so are the majority of Syrians. And there are, you know, there is quite a big cross-section of people who are in the opposition. So,
yeah, the Alawites are the ruling party. They've run the government for decades. The Sunnis are the majorities. There's also a majority, as I understand it, there's also a significant Christian population in Syria as well. And up to the conflict... They had lived in mixed neighborhoods and so forth. I understand now that that's really starting to end and that people are moving into areas controlled by whatever group they happen to be part of.
Yeah, like I said, it is taking on some really ugly sectarian overtones. And of course, you know, from the opposition, there are real accusations that the regime in Syria has deliberately sort of transformed this conflict into a sectarian struggle. They wanted to really crack down on it with the military instead of dealing with a popular uprising that would really expose them as being unpopular or whatever. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean it's a scary thing how the conflict is transforming. Absolutely.
There have been reports of defections from the Syrian army, including, well, a top general and a friend of President Assad has defected. How is that affecting the Syrian military? I mean, they have the advantage in equipment and arms. What about their troops? How secure are they?
They remain pretty secure. If you look at the big picture, I mean, there have been some high-profile defections. This former Syrian general who appeared on TV last night and confirmed that he had defected was, you know, obviously embarrassing to the president of Syria, to Bashar Assad, because he was a close friend of the president's. And so for him to leave was embarrassing. We also had the case of a fighter pilot defecting in his in his plane, which is quite a dramatic way of abandoning the regime. But for the most part, the military in Syria has stayed pretty ironclad. If you compare it to Tunisia and to Egypt and to Libya, it has been strikingly ironclad. And part of this is because over the years, Bashar Assad and his father, who ruled before he did, they sort of they stacked the key military posts with members of their Alawite sect. And doing that sort of melded the fate of the military and the regime. You know, the military wants this regime to stay in power. It's an existential sort of crisis for them. If the regime falls, then the military could face reprisal, killings, and that sort of thing. So for the most part, the regime has stayed basically intact. The military has stayed basically intact, despite some high-profile defections that are increasing. This could, mm-hmm. this could steamroll, but they have stayed mostly intact.
So, and I know we need to move on here, but this has the look of a conflict that is set to last for quite a while here.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. And, you know, the even if Bashar Assad did fall, that wouldn't be the end of it. I mean, really, it would just usher in phase two of a very bloody and protracted crisis. Absolutely.
Yeah, then you have to pick up the pieces, and that's where we're going to go next. So, Elizabeth Kennedy, we'll say goodbye to you, and thank you very much
for
being part of our discussion this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Kennedy is the Lebanon and Syria Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, and she joined us from Lebanon this morning. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will talk about what comes after the Assad regime falls, as everyone seems to assume that it will. So assuming that the Assad regime does eventually collapse, what comes after that? And there are a number of rather ominous signs about what comes after that. We'll talk about that, and we'll take your calls related to that in just a moment. Here's the phone number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:26. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about Syria this morning, and we've kind of broken this down into three areas. We talked about the situation on the ground right now and who's winning, who's not, and what it looks like from ground level. And then now we're going to talk about what comes after. Assuming that the Assad regime falls, what is going to happen in Syria when that takes place, and how do we go forward from that? And then at the last quarter of the hour, we will spend that time talking about the refugee problem. Lots of thousands of people displaced by the fighting in Syria. What's happening to them? and what's that situation like? So for this segment of the program, we welcome Mark Lynch, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University, and he's also a contributor to Foreign Policy magazine. Professor Lynch, good morning and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. There's a lot of talk about a post-Assad Syria, but he's still in power. Any chance that he will hold on, or is his removal a foregone conclusion?
Well, nothing is a foregone conclusion. And I think that, you know, he can probably drag this out for quite some time. And, you know, it could very well be a long, bloody fight. But I think in the end, though, if you look at the extent to which he's lost control over significant portions of his territory, lost legitimacy with his people, lost international support, facing overwhelming sanctions, and basically just has so much blood on his hands, it's very difficult to see how he could remain in power over the long term. But I don't think anybody should assume that this is going to end quickly or easily.
Does it matter how the Assad regime ends? I mean, is there a better way for this to happen, or are there some worst-case scenarios?
Well, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of criticism of Kofi Annan and the UN's efforts to find a political transition. But the entire point of that was to try and avoid the kind of state collapse and descent into civil war, which we're now seeing. And, you know, if we had been able to come up with a way to persuade Assad and his key people to leave power, to hand over to an inclusive, representative, transitional government, we might have been able to envision something in Syria which would not be the disaster which we see unfolding before us now. You know, in many ways, what we're going to see, or what we appear to be seeing now, where an insurgency basically carries out this long, grinding campaign, which will finally bring about a collapse of the regime. In many ways, that is the worst-case scenario, because we're going to be seeing this long period of destruction, political polarization, revenge killings, and then at the end, nothing in place to replace it. No clear political vision, no political institutions. And so I think a lot of us who are following Syria closely, we see this as, in many ways, almost the worst way that this could end.
Yeah, this is starting to look a lot like Iraq.
Well, you know, there's facile comparisons to Iraq, which we should avoid, and then there's real ones, which we should take very seriously. And I think that we are looking at something which isn't all that different from the summer of 2003, when you began to see the occupation beginning to unravel, and sectarian polarization, an insurgency standing up, and you know the conditions of how Syria got to where it is are very, very different from how Iraq got to where it was. Iraq had no, it didn't have this peaceful mobilization and everything else that we've seen, but starting from where we are right now and looking at how things are unfolding, it's very difficult to be optimistic.
There has been some criticism of President Obama because the United States did not intervene militarily in Syria. Should the United States have stepped in? And if they had done that, would we have been able to be successful in bringing about whatever situation it is we really want?
Oh, I think there's almost no question that Obama's been correct to keep the United States out of Syria militarily. I mean, I think that he should actually be receiving quite a bit of credit for avoiding what could be, if you want to talk about an Iraq analogy, the idea of American troops being slowly and inexorably dragged into a presence on the ground trying to either overthrow Assad or to try and maintain and occupy Syria after Assad. I think that's a place where nobody or very few Americans really want to go. I think that the argument for intervening militarily earlier was based in what I think is a very noble and very, very authentic desire to do something to help the Syrian people. And that's something that I actually share quite strongly. But when you actually think about what the United States could do through air power or through the kind of establishing a no-fly zone and what that would actually entail, you realize very quickly that there were no easy solutions, that bombing or doing the sorts of things that you hear some of the advocates talk about wasn't going to solve the problem. What it was going to do was simply accelerate the violence and then further embroil the United States in this disaster which we're seeing. So I really think that when you take a step back and you look at it, it's hard to say that what the United States has been doing has solved the crisis, but it could be a heck of a lot worse for us had we gotten involved.
You pointed this out, and Elizabeth Kennedy, who we just talked to, alluded to this also, that at the very beginnings of this thing, the people who were opposed to the Assad regime were that this was a political opposition. They wanted some reforms. They wanted regime change, but they wanted a truly representative democracy in Syria, and they wanted a voice in the government. And it started out as rather peaceful. So there was a point at this thing where there could have been some kind of negotiated settlement that would have resulted in a peaceful change of one group to another. But even if that had happened, given the longstanding enmity between the Sunnis and the Alawites in Syria, would we not have seen some sectarian violence anyway?
Well, you know, this is the real tragedy of Syria, is that, you know, if you think about the almost unimaginable courage of these people who risked torture, death, horrible repression to go out peacefully and demand democracy and human rights and the sorts of things they were demanding back in the first half of 2011, you could see there the possibility of something which could be a really positive change. But I think that the loss of that, the blame for it, has to fall almost entirely on the Assad regime, that basically it saw the peaceful protesters respond with bullets and with horrible violence and repression. And I think that what we've seen over the last year and a half has been inexorably advocates of that kind of peaceful protest and transition have been sidelined in favor of the armed groups because, you know, there's only so much you can do when your peaceful protests are being gunned down, right? I mean, there's only so much you can do when you're calling for coexistence and the response is this kind of bloodshed. So I think that I don't think you should go back and say that what we saw back in March and April of 2011 was necessarily going to lead to the kind of alienation, atrocities, polarization, which we now see. I think that's a function of the violence, and I think that violence was chosen by the Assad regime as the best way to stay in power.
Is there any chance at all that some of the leaders of the early opposition movement, if any of them are still left, I know a lot of them were killed or tortured, is there any chance at all that they can regain control of the opposition if Assad is removed, or are we going to be left with those who are much more inclined toward military solutions to whatever questions remain?
Again, there's absolutely no certainty about any of this. In other words, what we're seeing right now and what we've been seeing for several months is an attempt both within the Syrian opposition and by outside actors, including the United States, to try and help to organize the Syrian opposition in some way that when they do come to power, they'll be in a position to create an inclusive and representative government. I think that the nightmare would be that if you don't have that kind of organized, effective opposition political structure in place, that after Assad falls, what you'll be left with is something like Afghanistan in the 1990s, where you have armed groups and warlords fighting it out for power. And that's the worst case scenario that I was talking about before. You could get there, but you could still also at this point have a hope that, you know, the opposition can look at that developing, they can see it happening, and maybe step back from that brink and make serious efforts now to try and build that kind of inclusive and representative government. And that's really the best hope that we have right now, is that you can see the emergence of a Syrian opposition political structure, which it doesn't really have right now.
What role do you see for other Middle Eastern countries in the post-Assad Syria? How can they help to achieve the kind of positive outcome that we'd all like to see there?
Well, see, the problem is that they can help and they can hurt because, you know, you've got, you know, a very large number of people who just want to help the Syrian people and end the violence and try and create a more democratic Syria. But then you've also got a lot of foreign players with their own agendas. And maybe some of them just want to hurt an Iranian ally. Maybe some of them want to make sure that their own people end up in power. And so, you know, you could imagine a situation where Turkey, where Syria's neighbors, including Turkey and the Gulf states and Iraq and all the others, could come together in this contact group and plan and cooperate for the transition. But you could also imagine it becoming the kind of proxy war that we saw in Iraq for so many years, where you have each neighbor propping up their allies, promoting their own people. And then that could basically put that that internal struggle for power I was talking about on steroids. Again, this is a place where the United States has a real role, and it's been working hard on this for months, and it'll have to keep doing so, which is to try and coordinate those international, those other players, and try and make sure that they're all working together. It's not going to be easy, but I think that's one of those areas where the U.S. has an indispensable role.
Well, this area, this region is important. I mean, not just Syria, but the region is important to the United States. It's important to Russia. It's important to the Chinese energy interests. The fall of Assad, would that who does that help the most? Would that allow the United States to gain the upper hand in the Middle East? Who would be helped the most of the outside powers by Assad's fall?
So much depends on what emerges after the fall of Assad, because you basically have to decide, you know, it makes a difference whether you end up with some kind of reasonably stable Syrian democracy or if you end up with chaos, a vacuum, proxy war, and those others, those very different scenarios. I think everybody assumes that Assad's fall is bad for Iran, and that's almost certainly true. But who's going to actually benefit from it? It's way too early to call. I mean, just remember, you know, 2003 in Iraq when, you know, we assume that we get rid of Saddam Hussein, who's, you know, a longtime enemy of the United States. We would assume that this is that his replacement is going to serve American interests. And what do we have today? We have an Iraqi government, which is certainly not an enemy of the United States, but which has very good relations with Iran. And, you know, that's the kind of outcome which, if you talked about it in 2003, most people wouldn't have believed it.
Mm-hmm. What's the United States saying to Israel? Because they have to be awfully nervous about what's going on in Syria.
I think the Israelis are very worried about what's happening in Syria and in Egypt and around most of the region, to be honest. And I think the United States is doing everything it can to work with Israel and to reassure it and to try and do what it can to help its security. And I think that you've seen, for example, the work that we've been doing on with trying to restrain Syrian use of chemical weapons. And, you know, I think what the United States is trying to do basically is to work closely with the Israelis on their security issues and trying to help them deal with this rapidly changing Middle East. And again, it's not only Syria, but also Egypt, where we've been really working with the new Egyptian government to make sure that they will honor the Camp David peace agreement and that sort of thing. So, you know, Israel is understandably nervous, and I think the United States has been doing everything it can to try and reassure them and help them. But, you know, how can you not be nervous when you have a civil war taking place across your border?
Yeah, let's go to the phones, and I just lost my call screen. I think it was Mike in Appleton. Is that it? Whoever's next, let's take them.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah, I understand the non-intervention part. You know, I mean, who wants to get U.S. troops in there? However, what about these chemical weapons? I mean, can you imagine if half a dozen artillery shells with mustard gas got into the wrong hands? So I don't see how we can avoid not going in, at least to secure that part.
And what about that? I mean, the revelation that Syria has chemical weapons, very disturbing. And what should be our response to that? And how's that going to play out?
What the United States has been doing thus far, and not just the United States, but interestingly, Russia as well, has been to make really, really clear to Bashar al-Assad that the use of chemical weapons would be a red line. And I think it's very important that Russia has been on board in that effort. The other side of that, and what the caller was getting even more at, though, was what happens if the state collapses and suddenly those chemical weapons are in a free-for-all and people can go and snatch them in the chaos which follows. And that is an incredibly tough question. It's not clear to me what value a U.S. military intervention would be in terms of securing those chemical weapons, though. Think about the chaos. Just think about the chaos in Iraq in 2003 and that sort of thing. And that was with hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops on the ground. And what a hard time we had finding chemical weapons of mass destruction there. And I don't think anybody would be talking about that level of U.S. Presence. So I would say that this is a real problem, and it's one which I think keeps the U.S. government up at night. But there's limited options beyond what we're doing right now.
Well, do we even know where these chemical weapons are being stored?
I maybe they do, but I doubt it.
Okay. Well, that brings up another issue, and maybe this is more. Maybe this I would have better should have asked this question in the previous segment. But one of the problems, and one of the problems in even predicting the how things will go after Assad is gone, is that our intelligence inside Syria has been spotty at best.
I mean, there's enormous blind spots in there. And so, for example, one of the things which helped us quite a lot in a place like Egypt was simply the fact that we had a long-term relationship there, embassy, relations with the military. And we knew quite a lot about the internal workings of Egypt. And that just hasn't been the case. Now, I have to admit that a lot of these stories that you've seen in the newspaper the last few days about how the CIA doesn't know anything and isn't doing anything, I might take all that with a grain of salt. Generally speaking, you don't necessarily believe everything the spies tell you.
Especially when they tell you they don't know anything.
Especially when they tell you that they're not doing anything or they don't know anything. I mean, because if they did know, they obviously wouldn't tell you. But more broadly than that, though, I think there's enormous questions about the what's going on inside of Syria that I think we do have limited insight into, the nature of the opposition, and it's an enormously fragmented, diverse opposition with lots of different wings. And, people say, well, why don't we just arm America's friends among the opposition? Well, who are they? It's much more difficult than that. And I think that our intelligence there is quite limited, but maybe not quite as limited as the press reports have led us to believe.
Well, Professor Lynch, thank you for spending this time with us this morning. We need to move on and talk about the refugee problem next, but I appreciate your giving some clarification to a really, really complicated situation there.
Well, good to talk to you.
Mark Lynch is director of the Institute for Middle East Studies at George Washington University. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Istanbul-based journalist Justin Vila about what's happening with all the refugees. Of course, anytime you have an armed conflict, you have thousands who are displaced. Where do they go? What kind of conditions are they living under? And will they be able to return to their homes when this is all over? There's some question about that as well. So those things will all be up for discussion. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment on the refugee situation in Syria, call us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org, or you can leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. It's 9:47. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. For the remainder of the hour, we're going to shift our focus to the displaced people of Syria, refugees forced from their homes by the fighting who have fled Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and elsewhere, and are reduced often to living in tents or in cargo containers. under who knows what conditions, some good, some bad. But these people have been forced from their homes, and that's never a good thing. Joining me to talk about the Syrian refugee issue is Justin Vila, an Istanbul-based journalist. Justin Vila, good morning and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program.
Hi, good morning. Just a minor thing, it's Justin Vella.
Vella, okay, I'm sorry.
No problem. As
the fighting has escalated in Damascus, there were reports of cars being queued for hours waiting to cross into Lebanon. Some 60,000 refugees have already fled there, thousands more to Turkey and some, I believe, to Jordan. How are these host countries, and let's start with Lebanon, how are they coping with this influx of refugees?
Well, you know, they're really struggling. Lebanon in particular has a very tense situation. And because of this, the government hasn't really been able to, you know, extend much help. There's not official refugee camps at the moment in Lebanon. And in just in the past couple of days, I think yesterday, the Lebanese government, you know, officially requested for the international community to help support the refugees in Lebanon for the first time. So there should be some more aid coming, but it will be more from the international community as opposed to the actual Lebanese government.
Well, I mean, the Lebanese government hasn't really been stable for all that long itself. I mean, they must really be strapped for the resources that you would need to deal with this sudden influx of tens of thousands of people.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Lebanon has been tense for decades, and the government doesn't have a lot of resources. And then also the massive influx of refugees led, you know, the country into a very dangerous place. Because it threatens to destabilize what is already a very tense situation in Lebanon with the different ethnic and religious sects that are all living together in a very small country. And when you have all these Sunni Syrian refugees come across the border all of a sudden, you know, it's really quite threatening to the country.
Okay. What about Turkey? A little bit different situation there.
Right. Yeah. And Turkey, I live in Istanbul, and, you know, Turkey is the area where I have the most experience with the refugees. Turkey, I think of all the countries where Syrian refugees have fled to, has really stepped up and tried to provide for them in a way that other countries just aren't able to. You know, the country is doing, you know, very well economically. It has many more resources than the other countries in the area. And so what you've seen the Turkish government do is establish a series of refugee camps in the border area, and they're starting to build a few more a little bit further back away from the border as well. And so they're allowing refugees to live in, you know, essentially every family gets a tent where they live, and they're provided food. The children have access to a school in the refugee camp, though it's only in Turkish, the teachers are only teaching in Turkish, which is kind of strange. But Turkey is allowing the refugees to live in the tents, and, you know, they're providing for them, and they're also allowing them freedom of movement, which is quite interesting, I think, that the refugees are being allowed to come and go from Syria if they want to. So of all the countries, I think that, you know, Turkey is really doing the most for the refugees.
Yeah, they've established more or less a no-fly zone along their southern border. They've put anti-aircraft weapons there, and they've told the Syrians that if you fly any planes within or helicopters within 5 miles of our border, we're going to shoot them down. This has, in effect, created kind of a buffer zone for the Syrian opposition forces, and they apparently have been crossing back and forth in and out of Turkey pretty much unimpeded.
Yes and no. I mean, they are able to cross back and forth between Turkey unimpeded by the Turkish authorities. There is even some of the refugees are given identity cards when they arrive at the camp, and if they want to, you know, go to Syria, they can go through an unofficial border gate and into Syria, and then, you know, come back the same way and come back to the camp. It's quite interesting. I last week I was watching refugees arrive and then some refugees actually go back through an unofficial crossing that's watched over by the Turkish border guards there. And everyone's stamped in and out. I mean, not with, you know, an actual visa, but everyone's kind of, you know, everyone's name is written down and take, if they want, you know, food, medical supplies. Others just kind of, you know, walk across whatever border is closest to them. But as far as this buffer zone, it's more true in other places, or in some places rather than others. There are some areas just across from Turkey that are very safe, and others are still very dangerous. Two nights ago, I was in a few villages inside Turkey, just along the border, and they were shooting and shelling very close to the borders. And some of the people living there said, you know, just a few nights before, Syrian helicopters come very close to the border. So I don't think that we can yet say that Turkey has allowed or has, you know, established a no-fly zone or a buffer zone, you know, 5 kilometers into Syria. That's not happening yet. That's mostly rhetoric from the Turkish government. In practice, they're still fighting very close to the border. People are being hurt, I mean, wounded and killed very, very, very close to the border still. So, of course, the refugees in Turkey want that to happen, but it's not quite happening yet.
How many of these refugees are rebel soldiers, and how many are soldiers who are defectors from the Syrian army? I mean, I know you probably don't have an exact number, but do you have a sense of who these people are?
I think now it's quite clear that by far most of the rebels are just, you know, ordinary people, you know, like you or me, that had their relatives hurt in some way. Maybe they were arrested, maybe they were killed. You know, they had friends, family that were taken by the regime, or they just wanted to, they saw that, you know, finally they might have the chance to overthrow, you know, what has been a brutal dictatorship. And so they started to fight back. They started to take up weapons. These are farmers. These are, just everyone, farmers to pharmacists to university students. I would say now the actual defectors are, you know, in the minority. The majority of the people fighting the Syrian regime and in this, you know, so-called Free Syrian Army, the majority of the rebels are just normal people.
Mm-hmm. And there's a refugee camp, I believe it's at Kilis, K-I-L-I-S. I'm probably
that's
mispronouncing
right.
It, but that's that's in Turkey. They're housing about 12,000 people. They've got more or less a city there. You mentioned schools, but they have banks and food markets. These are paid for and protected by the Turkish government. Obviously, these people aren't living in the lap of luxury, but some, about 12,000 anyway, seem to be doing fairly well here.
Right, Kilis is one of the newest camps. And is definitely one of the nicest. The refugees don't have actual banks. What the Turkish government is doing is allowing them to have, essentially it's like credits that every refugee is allotted, and then they can go to a little store that's in the camp, and with their credits, I mean, not actual money, they can buy vegetables or, you know, maybe if the kids want a toy, something like that. And what a Turkish foreign ministry person told me is that, you know, they could just hand them the food as they've, you know, been doing, but this also just gives them something to do. Because, you know, one of the most perhaps unobserved difficulties of being a refugee is it's really boring. I mean, you're just, you know, you're sitting, you're really worried about everything that's going on in the country that you fled, and you don't want to go back, but there's not a whole lot you can do, especially, you know, in a situation that the Syrian refugees are in Turkey, where they're not officially allowed to work, or, you know, they're not officially allowed to rent apartments in, if they have some money. Some still do, and some, you know, do their best to find jobs, but the majority of them are just kind of sitting and twiddling their thumbs.
And we only have about a minute. Actually, we have about 30 seconds left. But give me a sense of, is there optimism within the refugee population about being able to eventually go back to their homes or not?
There definitely is. And, I mean, I just want to, you know, really kind of highlight that there's a lot of them that regularly go back into Syria. And some of them are fighting with the rebels and come back into Turkey to rest. Or others are carrying medical supplies, food, clothing, sometimes weapons. And then there's a very interesting, very vital number of the refugees that go back only to carry back into Turkey wounded people. These are like human ambulances. And it really, I think, highlights, you know, the plight of the Syrian people that, you know, someone from Turkey has to go and pick them up and carry them across the border.
And we need to leave it there. We're out of time. I'm sorry. Justin Vella, thank you very much for being with us this morning. I really appreciate it. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.